Watchman's Teaching Letter, Volume 4, Various Topics. Watchman's Teaching Letter Number 62, June 2003, from the 2003 Watchman's Teaching Letters by Clifton Emmeheiser, read by Dan Adams. This is my 62nd monthly teaching letter and continues my 6th year of publication. Because there are so many bad teachings circulating around in all areas of Scripture, I find myself on a continuous treadmill in order to combat them. At the present time, I have so many irons in the fire, I don't know which one to address next. The only advantage I can see coming out of this chaos is the fact that it makes the rest of us study all the more intensely. The problem with this is, they can dream these fantastic screwball ideas faster than I can quell them. Sadly, all this confusion is scattering the sheep rather than gathering them. Clifton here is, of course, making reference to Matthew 12:30. He that is not with me is against me, and he that gathereth not with me scattereth. We have been doing a walkthrough of Daniel's prophecies, and it has come to my attention again that many of us, in fact most of us, simply don't know the history of both houses of Israel up until Daniel's time. It is impossible, therefore, to make any sense of Daniel without this historical knowledge. Time after time after time, I read in Israel identity materials that the 10 northern tribes went into Assyrian captivity and Judah went into Babylonian captivity. Such a blanket statement is only about 50% correct, in other words, 50% incorrect. Now, if one doesn't want to be among that great majority who are only 50% correct, he will of necessity have to do some study to show himself approved. If you don't already have Hammond's Atlas of the Bible Lands, edited by Harry Thomas Frank, professor of religion at Oberlin College, Oberlin, Ohio, copyright 1977, published by Hammond Incorporated, I highly recommend you get a copy. Also advisable would be an outline history of the 70 Weeks Nation by the Reverend Alban Heath, which might still be available through Clifton. The first mentioned publication has charts and maps that are reasonably accurate. On page B17 of the Atlas, there is a map showing the routes of the 5 different forays, campaigns, made by the Assyrians into what we call today Palestine, of which I will show 4 here, along with data from other sources. For the ruler Tiglath-Pileser III, he reigned between 745 and 727 BC and campaigned in Palestine between 734 and 732 BC. Shalmaneser V then reigned from 727 to 722 BC and between 724 and 722 BC he was campaigning in Palestine. Then Sargon II reigned between 722 and 705 BC, and in 721 BC he campaigned in Palestine. And Sennacherib followed him, reigning from 705 to 681 BC, and he campaigned in Palestine in 701 BC. Another must book is Reader's Digest Atlas of the Bible, edited by Joseph L. Gardner et al., especially chapters The Fall of Israel, Sennacherib Attacks Judah, End of Judah, and Exile in Babylon. During the reign of Shalmaneser III, northern Israel was first threatened and direct contact made by a series of raids when he sought to contain the pressure of the hill tribesmen in Urartu, Medes, and Persians in the Urmia region. After many victories elsewhere, Tiglath-Pileser III, 2 Kings 15:19 and 2 Kings 16:7-10, made a swift march down the coast of Gaza, whose king, Hanunu, fled to Egypt. He sacked the area and set up a golden statue of his royal self as a mark of victory, but did not push beyond Egypt's border at Nahal Musur. This advance took him through the territory of Damascus, Galilee, and northern Israel, which was called the Land of Omri, and after that counted as part of Assyria. After placing Pekah on the throne instead of Hoshea, he, Tiglath-Pileser III, may well have instigated the murder of the former Hoshea, 2 Kings 15:29 and 30. Thus we have a record of the beginning of several Assyrian invasions directed at the northern 10 tribes, culminating in their capture. Among these were the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. 1 Chronicles 5:26. Then came Shalmaneser V, who continued his predecessor's, Tiglath-Pileser III's, practice of periodically marching through Syria, collecting tribute. He made Hoshea of Israel a vassal, 2 Kings 17:3, but in his 7th regnal year, Hoshea ceased to pay the annual required tribute. Quick to react, Shalmaneser V besieged Samaria for 3 years, taking more northern Israelites captive when the city fell with the next Assyrian king, Sargon II, in 723 BC, removing them to Hala and Habor by the river Gozan in the cities of the Medes, 2 Kings 18, 9-11. Sargon II does not appear in Old Testament history, but Sargon II himself has left the following inscription: "In the beginning of my reign, the city of Samaria I besieged. I captured 27,280 of the inhabitants I carried away. 50 chariots in the midst of them I collected, and the rest of their goods I seized. I set my governor over them and laid upon them tribute and taxes, like those of the Assyrians. Sennacherib takes nearly half of the southern kingdom of Judah into Assyrian captivity." This is an important part of the story that most Bible students completely overlook, and this half doesn't include the many of Zara Judah and Pharez Judah that migrated away before the Assyrian invasions. Later, after taking all the 10 northern tribes of Israel captive, the Assyrian king Sennacherib, from 705 to 681, came up against all the fenced cities of Judah, taking them, 2 Kings 18:13. While scripture is silent on the subject of the deportation of Judah, Sennacherib himself has left the following record: "And Hezekiah, king of Judah, who had not bowed down to my feet, 46 of his strong cities, his castles, and the smaller towns in their neighborhood, beyond number with warlike engines. I attacked and captured 200,150 people, small and great, male and female, horses, mares, asses, camels, oxen, and sheep beyond number from the midst of them. I carried off and distributed them as a spoil. He himself, Hezekiah, like a bird in a cage inside Jerusalem, his royal city, I shut him up. After this, all that was left of the southern kingdom of Judah was Jerusalem, 2 Kings 18:13 and 17, 2 Chronicles 32:1 and 2, and Isaiah 36:1 and 2. Rightly does the Bible Knowledge Commentary by Wolverd and Zuck say on 2 Kings 18:13, "Next he, Sennacherib, attacked all the fortified cities of Judah except Jerusalem and captured the people," end quote. The 27,280 of the house of Israel and 200,150 of the house of Judah can hardly account for a fraction of their numbers. While Sargon's inscription might record a small division of the 46 cities of Judah, it surely doesn't necessarily account for all the Judahites taken captive. The population of Judah. Using scripture, we will cite various passages to ascertain the population of the southern kingdom of Judah at specific periods. At 2 Chronicles 13:3, we are told that Abijah put 400,000 men of war in battle array, compared to 800,000 by Jeroboam of the northern kingdom of Israel. totaling 1,200,000 between them. We find 1,160,000 in Judah under Jehoshaphat a generation or so later in both the Masoretic text and the Septuagint. At 2 Chronicles 25:5, we find 300,000 men of war in Judah over the age of 20 from a census. At 2 Chronicles 26:13, we observe 310,100 men of war under Uzziah, king of Judah. At 2 Chronicles 28:6, we see that 120,000 men of war under Ahaz of Judah were slain in one day by Pekah, king of Israel. Therefore, it is quite obvious with these statistics of just the fighting men of war, the considerable number of Judah when all the women, children, and old men beyond fighting age are counted. From this biblical and historical evidence, you can now see why we have so much trouble with proper biblical interpretation. In addition to a major part of Judah going into Assyrian captivity, many of Judah who went into Babylonian captivity had opportunity to join with Judah who were in Assyrian captivity. Jeremiah 50:4. So those returning to Jerusalem at the decree of Cyrus represented only a minor part of the original kingdom of Judah. Now, if you don't have a full understanding of these captivities, you still have some homework to do. In short, nearly all of Judah migrated into Europe with the other tribes. Another factor must also be taken into account, because the southern kingdom was also made up of Benjamites and a considerable number of Levites. They also were taken captive with Judah into Assyrian captivity at the same time and migrated into Europe also. The reason I'm compelled to reiterate all these weighty facts once more is because I continue to observe many, and some claim to be teachers, who haven't the slightest idea what it's all about. The history many of us don't know. I found it necessary to review some of this biblical history in order to bring our study of Daniel into perspective. In fact, without this history, it's quite impossible to grasp to whom, what, and how his prophecies apply. If one listens to prime-time mainline religion, Daniel's prophecies become one giant mass of confusion. For that same reason, let's summarize the general biblical historical narrative again. Before we start, and as we go along, it is imperative we define some terms. It is essential, therefore, when we use the term Israelite or Judahite, that we don't mean quote-unquote Jew. The true identity of the sons of Isaac, Anglo-Saxons, according to the prophets and Messiah's parables, was to be hidden until the time of the harvest, or sometimes stated as the time of the end, or the last days. Matthew 9:37-38, Matthew 13:30. Many people wonder if the Anglo-Saxons are Israel, why don't more know about it? Or why hasn't my pastor taught that? The answer is, it was prophesied that it would not be generally known until our present time. Psalm 83:3, they take crafty counsel against thy people and consult against thy hidden ones. In order to understand biblical prophecy today, one must know the identity of the Anglo-Saxon and related peoples. As we enter into biblical prophecy, we will also need to consider Bible history. One reason, and the main reason, people have difficulty with Bible prophecy is because they do not take the time to read Bible history. The first 16 or 17 books of the Bible are Bible history. For instance, how can anyone expect to understand the prophecies of Jeremiah, Isaiah, and Ezekiel if they're not familiar with and pay no attention to the books of the Bible setting forth the history leading up to those prophecies? If one can lay down these fundamental historical facts from biblical history, one can proceed into biblical prophecy and it will open up beautifully. One of the essential details to understand is that the word quote-unquote Jew does not appear in biblical history until 2 Kings 16:6, or 1,300 years after the death of Abraham. 2 Kings 16:6, Darby. At that time, Rezin, king of Syria, recovered Eloth to Syria and drove the Jews from Eloth, and the Syrians came to Eloth and dwelt there to this day. Also, it was 600 years after Moses brought the Isaac sons out of Egypt. All one need do to verify that is to check biblical chronology. The fact of the matter is, neither Abraham nor Moses were quote-unquote Jews. And before you get all bent out of shape, do a little thinking. Now, if Abraham was a quote-unquote Jew, as we hear, then many Arabs are quote-unquote Jews, for many Arabs can claim to be born from Abraham. Additionally, once we start using some common sense, if Abraham was a quote-unquote Jew, then his son Isaac was a quote-unquote Jew, and if Isaac was a quote-unquote Jew, then all the cursed Edomites are quote-unquote Jews also. When you hear statements like Abraham the Jew, Isaac the Jew, or Jacob the Jew, one can mark it down that the one making such an expression is not competent with the two-edged sword, for these were not quote-unquote Jews. If one is really proficient in biblical history, there is no dispute that Jacob, Isaac's other son, had 12 sons. One should be familiar with those sons' names and their descendants, tribes, which are called Reubenites, Simeonites, Levites, Issacharites, Zebulunites, Gadites, Danites, Naphtaliites, Asherites, Josephites, represented by the Ephraimites and Manassehites, Benjamites, and Judahites. The Judahites were not quote-unquote Jews, as the term has come to be used. Therefore, to see the expression quote-unquote Jew to mean Abraham, Isaac, or Moses is the most ridiculous, absurd thing that one could say to anyone that's familiar with biblical history. If we can't get some of these basic rudiments correct, we can neither understand scripture nor biblical history. It really has always gotten down to this, folks. Do you want to take the Jews' word for it? Or do you want the cold, hard, true facts? It's really up to you. When we trace biblical history, we must grasp the primary fact that the 12 sons became 12 tribes, or 13 tribes, if we include the two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. But under David, at about 1000 BC, they became one nation, which is an historical fact. If you're not familiar and don't understand, you cannot possibly understand what the scriptures prophesied concerning these people. Let us now read from 2 Samuel 5, 4 and 5, which presents an important historical fact and a key to understanding scripture. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. This is simply stating that David ruled 7 years and 6 months over Judah before he reigned the balance of his administration over both Israel and Judah. It's very clear in biblical history, even before the time of the Exodus, a division arose between Judah and Ephraim, with the two contending for leadership. That distinction and division continued from the time that Jacob was still living, and as they developed into tribes and nations, it lingered on. This shows in the fact that it took the house of Israel, Ephraim, 7.5 years to accept David's rule. So they were brought together as one nation under David, but that didn't last very long. After David's administration, we had Solomon's administration, and after the death of Solomon, it is needful to know that in 1 Kings 12, Rehoboam, Solomon's son, became king, and we read it in verses 19 and 20. So Israel rebelled against the house of David unto this day, and it came to pass, when all Israel heard that Jeroboam was come again, they sent and called him unto the congregation, and made him king over all Israel. There was none that followed the house of David, the tribe of Judah only, which included Benjamin and some Levites. In the balance of this chapter, we read what Yahweh said concerning this division into separate nations. For this thing is from me. Let's go to 2 Kings 17:5 and 6 to note further historical developments which give an understanding and a key to biblical prophecy. Then the king of Assyria came up throughout all the land, and went up to Samaria, 10 tribed Israel, and besieged it 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria, and carried Israel away into Assyria, and placed them in Halah and in Habor, by the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. Here we have one of the most important events in all the history of the Isaac sons, or the Anglo-Saxon, and related people. All this took place about 720 BC, and placed them in Assyria, and later toward the Black and Caspian Seas. Now, leaving the 10 tribes, we will return to 2 Kings 23:27, and we'll find what happened to the kingdom of Judah. And Yahweh said, I will remove Judah also out of my sight, as I have removed Israel, and I will cast off this city, Jerusalem, which I have chosen, and the house of which I said, my name shall be there. It should be repeated with emphasis that this is biblical history and is something we should all be able to agree on and accept. That is, if we believe the Bible is the word of Yahweh. So we have here the second captivity of Judah and Jerusalem by Babylon. Following this at 2 Kings 24:2 and 3. And Yahweh sent against him bands of the Chaldees, and bands of the Syrians, and bands of the Moabites, and bands of the children of Ammon, and sent them against Judah to destroy it, according to the word of Yahweh, which he spake by his servants the prophets. Surely at the commandment of Yahweh came this upon Judah, to remove them out of his sight, for the sins of Manasseh, according to all that he did. If we plunge into biblical prophecy without a foundation of biblical history, it simply will not make any sense, and we will have no way of proving we are correct. We cannot scripturally interpret prophecy unless it is done from such an understanding. If we do anything else, then we are blaspheming the Almighty, treating His surviving message to us as if they are fairy tales. So to be sure we are getting all of this in our minds, let's now go over this again. We have now learned that from the 12 sons of Jacob came 12 or 13 tribes, depending on how they are counted. Later they became one nation under David, but after the death of Solomon, the son of David, these tribes divided into two nations. This may seem elementary, but it is essential to understanding biblical prophecy. Samaria was capital for the 10-tribe Israel nation in the north, and Jerusalem was the capital of the 2-tribe Judah nation to the south. Again, it should be reiterated that in 720 BC, some 700 years before the first advent of Messiah, the Israel nations were taken into the Assyrian captivity, and extremely important, because it is usually overlooked, a major portion of the southern Judah nation was also taken into Assyrian captivity to join with the 10 tribes already there. Then about 100 years later, the remnant of that remaining Judah nation, which consisted mainly of Jerusalem, was taken into Babylonian captivity. The Bible is a history book and must be treated as such, and it is a history of one man's family. If you still don't understand, go back and keep rereading it until you do comprehend. Synchronizing prophecy. Jeremiah, in chapter 3, in the very beginning of his book, it again deals with biblical history. That history is simply this. Jeremiah prophesied at the time when the leftover Judah nation, which was not taken captive into Assyria, was about to be taken into Babylonian captivity. The northern Israel nation had gone into Assyrian captivity some 100 years before this, and once again falls under the category of biblical history. Hosea prophesied concerning Israel, while Jeremiah prophesied concerning both Israel and Judah. Should you have a desire to understand, continue to follow with us. Jeremiah was preaching and prophesying to the small residue Judah nation. As we have learned, Israel and most of Judah had been taken into Assyrian captivity and to regions north 100 years before this time, never to return. In Jeremiah 3:12, the Almighty speaks to his prophet Jeremiah, saying, "Go and proclaim these words toward the north, where Israel was, and say, Return, thou backsliding Israel, Israel and Judah, saith Yahweh, and I will not cause mine anger to fall upon you. For I am merciful, saith Yahweh, and I will not keep anger forever." This is a momentous passage overlooked by the majority of Bible students as far as the Isaac sons are concerned, which we will see as we go along. The message was, "You return back to me and my word, and I will not cause mine anger to fall upon you, and I will not completely destroy you." Then in verse 14, "Turn, O backsliding children of Israel and Judah, saith Yahweh, for I am married unto you, and I will take you, one of a city and two of a family, and I will bring you to Zion." Many try to imply that Yahweh was married only to Israel, not Judah, which categorically is not true. Judah simply joined Israel in her migrations. It is simply amazing how some people come up with all kinds of confused conclusions. This is a tremendous prophecy, and we must be able to discern the history when it was fulfilled. This was a long-range prophecy pertaining to the Israel and Judah people who were taken into Assyrian captivity. For those who don't understand this prophecy, it is a foretelling of the great Zion nation, America. Just pick up any truthful history book of the founding of our country and read about it, for it is a fulfillment of Jeremiah 3:14. "Return, backsliding children, saith Yahweh, for I am a husband unto you, and I will take you, one of a city and two of a family, and I will bring you to Zion." And where did all these people come from? Well, they came from the very region of the Black and Caspian Seas, from where they migrated into Europe, the British Isles, Germany, France, Scandinavia, etc. This was a very long-range prophecy, and Yahweh did take us in the manner he said he would, long-range, inasmuch as it was to last 2,520 years for each individual tribe. The rest of the prophecy in verse 15 reads, "And I will give you pastures according to my heart, which shall feed you with knowledge and understanding." Any pastor not feeding us with knowledge and understanding of who true Israel and Judah are not worthy of that dignity, nor our tithes of support. But the Israel and Judah of today are literally throwing tons of money at the false pastors. The only true pastors are the Israel identity teachers, identifying both the wheat, Israel and true Judah, along with the tares, the impostors called quote-unquote Jews, which constitute the two-seed line message of Genesis 3:15. The gospel without the first gospel is no gospel at all. Now let's take a look at some scripture contrasting the houses of Israel with the small residue Judah nation that didn't go into Assyrian captivity. I call your attention to how Jeremiah prophesied at chapter 18, verses 1 and 2. "The word which came to Jeremiah from Yahweh, saying, Arise and go down to the potter's house, and there I will cause thee to hear my words." In other words, Yahweh said to the prophet, "Jeremiah, go down to the potter, the man that makes vessels of clay. He places them upon a wheel, and then he molds them. Yahweh said to him, Go down and watch that man, because I'm going to give you an illustration. I'm going to give you an object lesson or a parable." Now continuing, Then I went down to the potter's house, and behold, he wrought a work on the wheels. The vessel that he made of clay was marred in the hand of the potter, so he made it again another vessel. It seemed good to the potter to make it. As Jeremiah watched, he waited for the message of the object lesson, as he knew Yahweh was going to show him something. As he watched this man, he noticed that that particular vessel he had on the wheel was marred, but he also noted that he made it again another vessel as seemed good to the potter to make. Now verses 5 and 6. Then the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, O house of Israel, cannot I do with you as this potter, saith Yahweh? Behold, as the clay is in the potter's hand, so are ye in mine hand, O house of Israel. While this is a parable, it is also a long-range prophecy to be fulfilled in history. And the prophecy is this: as this vessel was marred, so was the house of Israel marred and placed into Assyrian captivity. They were placed under bondage, judgment, and punishment. In other words, Yahweh was making Israel into another vessel, into nations he could use. It is important to note the potter did not throw the clay away, as churchianity tries to do with true Israel today. In other words, ever since the Assyrian captivity, true Israel and true Judah have been a vessel in Yahweh's hand to use for his purpose. There is another legal aspect to the potter and the clay, inasmuch as he purchased us, and the fact we are under covenant contract, he can legally do anything necessary to bring us back into line. We are the only people he ever purchased. Ever since Abraham offered Isaac on an altar, we are his possession. Being that is true, he has every right to chastise us until we conform to his ways. If you are a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, then you are under contract from your very first breath, and you cannot annul it, as you have no choice in the matter. But why would we want it any other way? End of the residue nation of Judah. The term residue is used at Jeremiah 24:8 and should be used accordingly. In the very next chapter of Jeremiah, or the chapter right after the potter and the clay, we have another tremendous prophecy. Chapters 18 and 19 alone should convince people that the quote-unquote Jews cannot possibly be the Israel people of the Bible. Going to Jeremiah 19:1, thus saith Yahweh, go and get a potter's earthen bottle, and take of the ancients of the people, and of the ancients of the priests. This time Yahweh is telling Jeremiah to go to the potter's house and get a clay bottle which has been baked hard and brittle. Then Jeremiah is instructed to take of the elder people and priests, the civil leaders and religious leaders, as witnesses, as he wants both church and state to see this illustration and understand its message. Now, Jeremiah, go get a bottle, not one that is soft and workable and in the process of being made, but a finished bottle. Then verse 2 says, and go forth unto the valley of the son of Hinnom, the city dump, which is by the entry of the east gate, and proclaim there the words that I shall tell thee. This is what Jeremiah was to say. Verses 3 and 4. And say, hear ye the word of Yahweh, O kings of Judah and inhabitants of Jerusalem. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the Elohim of Israel, behold, I will bring evil upon this place, the which whosoever heareth, his ears shall tingle, because they have forsaken me. In chapter 18 it was, O house of Israel, and in this chapter it is, O kings of Judah and inhabitants of Jerusalem. Remember here, we have both the leaders of church and state to go to the city dump outside the city gates where Jeremiah spoke the words we just read. Now follow along as we read verse 10. Then shalt thou break the bottle in the sight of the men that go with thee. Do you note the contrast and see the difference between chapters 18 and 19? Chapter 18, Israel was made into another vessel, whereas in 19 it is proclaimed, verse 11 in part, even so will I break this people and this city, as one breaketh a potter's vessel, that cannot be made whole again. Here again, this is a prophecy, and it wasn't completely fulfilled until 70 AD. Yet in spite of this very clear proclamation, the modern-day priests of Judeo-Churchianity claim the quote-unquote Jews returning to Palestine is a fulfillment of biblical prophecy. That residue nation is like Humpty Dumpty that had a great fall and all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. It's never going to happen. Like musical chairs called Going to Jerusalem, it'll always lack one chair then needed and end in confusion. It'll never fit the bill. Although that residue nation was condemned to extinction, still there were a very few good figs remaining until its end. Now, this not being made whole again has nothing to do with personal salvation, but has everything to do with which people were to be Yahweh's kingdom people and his special sovereign nations, or his vessels. Short-range prophecies. We will now shift from long-range prophecies to short-range prophecies. Going to the 25th chapter of Jeremiah, we will note a short-range prophecy on this residue Judah nation, or the Judah remnant that didn't go into Assyrian captivity. Reading now from Jeremiah 25:11-12, "And this whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. And it shall come to pass, when 70 years are accomplished, that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, saith Yahweh, for their iniquity, in the land of the Chaldeans, and will make it perpetual desolations." The same prophecy is repeated in Jeremiah 29:10. "For thus saith Yahweh, that after 70 years be accomplished at Babylon, I will visit you, and perform my good word toward you in causing you to return to this place." In other words, the people that were left in Jerusalem of Judah were to be carried into the Babylonian captivity, but unlike Judah in the Assyrian captivity, these were to return after 70 years. This corresponds to what we read in Daniel 9:1-2. "In the first year of Darius, I, Daniel, understood by the banks the number of years whereof the word of Yahweh came to Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem." We can see that Daniel, while in the Babylonian captivity, was familiar with the writings of Jeremiah and understood biblical history. Being aware of the prophecy, Daniel prayed for its fulfillment. We will now consider Ezra 1:1-3. "Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and put it also in writing, saying, Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, Yahweh Elohim of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he hath charged me to build him an house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah." For what followed, we will go to verse 5. "Then rose up the chief of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites, with all them whose spirit Yahweh had raised, to go up to build the house of Yahweh which is in Jerusalem." Outstanding here is the fact that the three tribes involved in the rebuilding were Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. This is substantial evidence that, contrary to what is being taught today by the mainstream churches, all the tribes didn't return to Jerusalem. It's not scriptural, and it couldn't possibly be. The other tribes, including the major part of Judah, were in the Assyrian captivity, and the bulk never returned. This is by no means all the history with which one should be familiar in Scripture, but it does represent some of the most important facts. Very few fathom them. The main purpose for addressing this topic is to give us a better foundation for understanding Daniel's prophecies. By examining most of the history from Abraham to Daniel, we can better understand the conditions under which he prophesied. While we have covered much on Daniel, there is still more to address. Of all the misused and abused books in the Bible, Daniel probably stands at the top of the list. Not only that, but we are informed that his writings would not be fully understood until the end. And I hope we have made some progress in that direction. If no other thing is to be learned from this issue, and if we don't remember anything else, we should never forget that a major part of Judah went into Assyrian captivity and migrated into Europe with the other 10 tribes. We should also remember that when it speaks of the southern kingdom of Judah, it includes both Benjamites and Levites. Once we understand generally where all the tribes went, we then have no problem with James 1:1, which says, James, a servant of Yahshua, the Messiah, to the 12 tribes scattered abroad, greetings. You will notice that James didn't say anything about 10 tribes, so we can be quite sure he knew where true Judah was that had gone into Assyrian captivity. True Judah consists of Germans, Scots, and Irish, and the false quote-unquote Jews claiming to be Judah are merely Judah through his Canaanite wife, Genesis 38:2, and also by Esau's taking of Canaanite Hittite wives, thus disqualifying them as heirs. End of Watchman's Teaching Letter number 62. Thank you for listening.